Good morning. As Pastor Rogers said, we're going to be talking about Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who was if you're not familiar, he was a German pastor, theologian, who lived in Germany from 1906 to 1945. So he was only alive for 39 years. And yet I was surprised as I was starting my prep last week on Bonhoeffer. I was realizing I might have bitten off a little more than I could chew because the shortest biography I could find was 500 pages. And I was a little bit of a panic, and I'm realizing that if you're a pastor, but you also are an assassin or functioning in a role in an assassination plot against Hitler, people are going to have a lot to say about you. I'm like, okay, there's a lot of material on this guy. So thankfully, Levi saved me and was like, actually, there's an abridged version of one of those. So it was only 230 pages, not 600. Saved me a little bit. And so I'll recommend, too, if any of you are interested, we're not going to be able to cover everything there is to cover about Dietrich Bonhoeffer this morning. So Eric Metaxas has a great biography that there is an abridged version to. And then I was at Crown, and one of the Crown students, they pointed me to this graphic novel about Bonhoeffer's life by John Hendricks. And before you write it off and go, okay, it's just a bunch of pictures, it is a bunch of pictures and some wonderful art in here. I'm gonna have different pictures from the book up on the screen this morning just because they were so interesting, so well done. But I don't know if you can see this, there's a lot of content in there too. And honestly, after reading the biography, and then I read through this, and I'm like, I could have just probably read through this. It is well written, well researched, and so families, if you're interested in studying Bonhoeffer, excellent book to check out. And so what I want to do is just start with a quick history lesson, because I think we need to understand Bonhoeffer's context, all right? The world in which he was living, and something happens when we read history, and it's this temptation to read with a sort of prejudice where we look back on people in history and we think we're better. Especially, I think this is relevant when we're talking about Nazi Germany, and we're talking about the Christians who live there. And then we're asking the question, well, how could anyone have fallen for that? How could anyone have bought into Hitler's deception? How could they have supported this? And so let's just backtrack a little bit and talk about Germany in the 1920s. So in the 1920s, it looked nothing like Germany did about 10 years before, because World War I had happened. And Germany came out of World War I, and the economy was crippled, and the politics were a mess, just crazy, just chaos, complete chaos. Inflation reached all-time high. And so, you know, we're talking about gas inflation right now in the U.S. Let me give you consider for a moment Germany in the 1920s. So in 1921, the German form of currency, the mark, was valued at 75 marks to the U.S. dollar. So that's 1921, so 75 marks to the U.S. dollar. 2 years later, in 1923, it was valued at 4 billion marks to the U.S. dollar. And so Dietrich Bonhoeffer's father, so there's a story in the biography about how he had to draw out an insurance policy that he'd been paying on for decades. Years and years and years, he's making payments into this insurance policy. And he was from a pretty wealthy family, but he had to pull the money out to buy food for the family. And all he could afford after those years and years was a couple of strawberries for his family. So millions of people out of work. They're poor, they're hungry. And then there's this sense that they're just ashamed of being a defeated people. And so that's the situation, that's the context where we get Hitler. Okay, because Hitler's a fighter. He's charismatic, and he tells the German people a story that they're longing to hear. Tells them a story that the Germans are a special people destined by God to overthrow their enemies and reclaim the glory that they once had. And so maybe we're thinking, okay, general population might buy this, but come on, the Christians, the church, And here's what I would say. So in studying Bonhoeffer, by default, you end up studying Hitler. And so I learned a lot about Hitler that I didn't know. He was a master manipulator. He had mastered the art of deception. In private, the man hated Christianity. He just despised it, thought it was weak, thought it was worthless. On a couple occasions, he said, why couldn't Germany have had any other religion? Why did it have to be Christianity? So that's what Hitler says in private. But publicly, he brands himself as a champion for the church, a champion for morality. He's meeting with church leaders and he's saying, guys, I'm going to fight for you. I'm going to defend Christianity. He even at one point in an early speech, he called Jesus the great Aryan hero. So he's like, Jesus is the German hero. So I take a step back and I go, okay, if that was me, I don't know that I would know any better. I probably would think, hey, I like this guy. He's willing to fight for what I believe in. And he's willing to fight for this country. And so at this point in time, we're gonna switch over now to Bonhoeffer. He was a young man in his early 20s, and he was studying in Berlin at the university. And I'm not going to cover any of his early life. That's if you want to read outside of this morning, definitely do so. But we're going to jump to his 20s. He's just brilliant. So he starts his first doctorate when he's 21 years old, and then he starts a second doctorate 3 years later. And I'd like to imagine that in a different world, Bonhoeffer would have become a famous scholar. I mean, he already is famous, but even more so. It's said about Bonhoeffer that he hated the casual conversations that most people have, because like they just spend time talking about things that don't really matter. And so he didn't like to just shoot the breeze. If you just want to talk about the weather, you wouldn't want to go talk to Bonhoeffer, okay? He wanted to be intentional. He wanted to talk about things that had value and purpose. And again, I'd like to think in a different world, he maybe would have gone on to become a famous scholar, professor. And he did teach. He did teach at the university. But the truth about Bonhoeffer was that his first love was the church. His parents, his family, they pushed him. They wanted him to keep ascending the academic ladder. But he cared a lot more about the church. He once said that if somebody couldn't communicate the most profound ideas about God in the Bible to children, then something was amiss. And so true to his word is during this period of time, he took a confirmation position, teaching confirmation classes to a bunch of kids that nobody else wanted to teach. These were the kids that were rough around the edges. I think the way they described it is they're from the other side of the tracks. And so Bonhoeffer takes this position. They'd already chewed up and spat out a bunch of teachers, but they loved Bonhoeffer. And you're like, okay, there's got to be something about this guy that even these kids who are rough, they're rowdy, and yet they love him. So in 1933 is when Hitler started to strip off the facade, the public persona, and started to reveal some of his true intentions. In a piece of legislation called the Aryan Paragraph. And so what the Aryan Paragraph did was it required the removal of anyone who was non-Aryan or of Jewish heritage from any part of civil service, which is a very broad category, including the church. So they were not allowed to be a part of the church. And the surprising and somewhat shocking part of this is that most church leaders just went along with it, describing it as unfortunate. And this was just the first of a number of compromises. Pastors began to wear the little distinctive bronze eagle, the little emblem of the Nazi regime on their collars. They started baptizing babies to Hitler. They started ending their services not with the doxology, but with the Nazi salute. They even put a swastika on the top of their Christmas trees. And here is one of those instances where I think the temptation is to go, why? Okay, what's going on with the Christian church in Germany? How are they going along with this? And I actually want to read a quote from one of the more influential pastors of the time, Martin Niemöller. He, at this point, had not taken a stand against the Nazis. But he would later go on to be one of the leading men in the resistance, would spend 8 years in prison. But he reflected on this point in time. He reflected back and I think gave a great summary of what's happening here. And this is what he said. He said, "First, they came for the socialists, and I did not speak out because I was not a socialist. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I did not speak out because I was not a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews, and I did not speak out because I was not a Jew. Then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak for me." And I think that was the attitude of so many. At this point, it's not affecting us. We're still believing that, you know, Hitler does, you know, he's going to defend the church, defend Christianity. It's not directly affecting me. And a lot of the leaders said, it's just better at this point in the long term if we just put our heads down, stay in our lane, and you know what? It'll probably just blow over. This is not a time to get involved. Bonhoeffer, on the other hand, was one of the first and seemingly the few Christians to publicly speak out. And so 2 weeks after this piece of legislation was published, he published his own paper titled The Church and the Jewish Question. And this paper, it was kind of like a modern-day prophet calling people to wake up. And so to his peers, he said, "If you board the wrong train, it is no use running along the corridor in the opposite direction." Meaning, okay, now's the time to get off the train. And if you just keep going with it, it's going to be too late. Now's the time to take a stand. And then in this paper, he outlined three possible responses that the church could have at this point in history. And he said, so first, we can question the state and its methods. A true church must protect itself and reject government encroachment on its beliefs. Second option, aid the victims of state action. The church has an unconditional obligation to the victims of any ordering of society. And then I want to focus on this third one, because this would come to define his approach, later in his years. Third, he said, strike back. It is not enough just to bandage the victims under the wheel, but to put a spoke in the wheel itself. And so Bonhoeffer immediately becomes a rebel. He's a dangerous person to associate with. A ban's placed on all his books. He loses his teaching position at the Berlin University. And I don't know if he minded all that much. Seems like he knew it was going to happen. And I will say this. A lot of people joined, you know, felt the same way Bonhoeffer did, and a lot of them joined him. So there were thousands of church leaders, and this maybe sometimes we don't hear about, there were thousands of church leaders that joined together in this resistance, and they formed their own separate church called the Confessing Church, kind of opposed to the Nazi-instituted church. And so there were a lot of Christians who were resisting, who were standing up. Bonhoeffer even started a kind of a secret seminary to train up leaders, because he thought maybe this is the way we can turn things around. And so he started his own seminary training up pastors and leaders. But when you read the biography, I think the impression you get, the feeling you get, is that it was just too little too late. They weren't able to slow down the Nazi propaganda juggernaut. And Hitler, I feel like the more entrenched he became, the more supported he became, the more bold and aggressive he got with his policy. And I think he knew, and again, I'll say this about Hitler, he's just a master at manipulating politics, knowing which buttons to push. And so an example is in 1936, during the Berlin Olympics. So Berlin was hosting the Olympics in 1936. And it was during the Olympics, while all the attention is on all the festivities and the celebration, that he pushes a law through making it illegal to associate with a non-Nazi church. And I think, in a way, that was kind of the nail in the coffin for this startup resistance. They weren't going to have a lot of impact after this point. Pastors were being arrested left and right. And so it put Bonhoeffer in a difficult position. What do I do now? And he was made aware of this growing conspiracy from within the government agencies to try to take out Hitler because he had a lot of influential family. Oh yeah, I've got this up here. So this is from the book. The three in blue, the three guys in blue, were one's his brother and the two were brothers-in-law. And they all worked in the Nazi government sort of undercover. And they told him about a conspiracy that was forming. And so he had a decision to make. Do I join them? Do I take a stand with these guys in what inevitably will be trying to kill Hitler? Something that, I'll say this about Bonhoeffer, like he was a pacifist. So he didn't believe in war. And so it was hard for him to imagine even aiding a group in an attempt to kill someone. But on the other hand, he's like, do I just stand by and watch as thousands suffer and die? And so the way he reasoned it out is he said this. He said, you know, if I saw a madman driving into a crowd with a car, he said, I wouldn't as a pastor just wait until after the damage was done and say, I'll bury the dead. He said, I would do something in that moment. I would take action. And so that's how he reasoned it. And it seems like he struggled with the decision. He wasn't completely sure it was the right decision, but he felt like it was the most loving thing to do in this moment. And so he decided to join this group. The cost was steep. And I think maybe the hardest thing for Bonhoeffer is he had to go join one of the government agencies. And so now all of these people that had saw him publicly speaking against the Nazis, speaking against Hitler, and all they see from the outside looking in is, oh, now he's just going to go and join. Okay, just going to throw that all away. And so for those who were not in his most inner circle, he kind of became an outcast. Even some of his good friends felt like he was a traitor. And so to summarize what happened next, there were three separate attempts on Hitler's life. And just incredible, they all failed. And it almost felt like supernatural how these things failed because they had it lined up perfectly three times. And it never worked. One of them, the third attempt was even made into a movie with Tom Cruise, Valkyrie. I'm not recommending it. I don't know if it's a good movie or not. But it was made into a movie. It was, I mean, here's what happened. One of the high-ranking generals was at a meeting with Hitler and a couple other guys. He had a bomb in his suitcase. He put it under the table, left the building. The building blows up. Four people die. Hitler got singed, essentially. Not even hurt. And it was like, what? And that was, by the third time, the Gestapo had finally closed in on this group of guys. Because they had been, slowly the circle had been smaller and smaller, and by the third attempt, they kind of ran out of time. And so Bonhoeffer is sent to prison, along with all of the other guys involved, and there he would stay. This is 1943, he would stay for 2 years. And so I just want to stop here, because that's essentially, we don't get a lot from Bonhoeffer during his time in prison. He wrote letters and things, but I want to stop and just say, okay, what's the takeaway from Bonhoeffer? What's the lesson from his life? Because he leaves kind of a complicated legacy. Right? Was he right? Was he wrong? People have debated this back and forth. And I think when we read his story, then the temptation is to assume that in our own story, we're the Bonhoeffer. And we're taking on the evils of our day, when what's probably true is we better resemble everyone else, because Bonhoeffer was an exception. He's the exception we want to be. I think if we're honest with ourselves, we're probably a lot more like the other Christians around him. And unlike so many in his day, he was willing to lean into the complicated and messy questions of life and try to come up with complicated answers. I like to say that Bonhoeffer was a thinking Christian. He was willing to think biblically, to think critically, to think deeply about issues, to think outside the box. And so in a way, his life is kind of a lesson in using wisdom, in using wisdom to navigate life. So was he right? Was he wrong? I don't even know if Bonhoeffer would be completely confident in his answer to that question, but what he did believe is that he was following the guidance of Martin Luther, where most of us are familiar with Martin Luther, another great German pastor theologian, who once made the statement, love God and sin boldly. It's a weird statement, but here's what he meant. He meant it's better to err on the side of loving action rather than doing nothing at all. So love God and sin boldly. It's better to err on the side of loving action than to do nothing at all. Bonhoeffer himself, he coined a phrase, cheap grace. And I want to read just a little excerpt from one of his writings as he describes the difference between cheap grace and costly grace. Here's what he said. Cheap grace is the preaching of forgiveness without requiring repentance. Baptism without church discipline, communion without confession, absolution without personal confession. Cheap grace is grace without discipleship, grace without the cross, grace without Jesus Christ living and incarnate. Costly grace is the treasure hidden in the field. For the sake of it, a man will go and sell all that he has. It is the pearl of great price to buy which the merchant will sell all his goods. It is the kingly rule of Christ for whose sake a man will pluck out the eye which causes him to stumble. It is the call of Jesus at which the disciple leaves his nets and follows him. Costly grace is the gospel which must be sought again and again, the gift which must be asked for, the door at which a man must knock. Such grace is costly. This is my favorite part. Such grace is costly because it calls us to follow, and it is grace because it calls us to follow Jesus Christ. It is costly, in this statement right here, because it costs a man his life, and it is grace because it gives a man the only true life. It is costly because it condemns sin, and grace because it justifies the sinner. Above all, it is costly because it costs God the life of his Son. Ye were bought at a price. And what has cost God much cannot be cheap for us. Above all, it is grace because God did not reckon his Son too dear a price to pay for our life, but delivered him up for us. Costly grace is the incarnation of God. And so, whatever you think about Bonhoeffer and his decision, I think we can agree that what is so admirable is that Bonhoeffer looked at Jesus and said, he gave me everything, how can I not do the same? How can I not act for the people around me? And so I just want to end with this final line of his life. I'm going to go back into his story. On 1845, 2 years after being in prison, Bonhoeffer was taken to be executed, and he knew it. And what's so sad about this, as I was reading it, it made me sad because the place where he was executed 1 week later would be liberated by American soldiers. A month later, the war would officially be over. So he is a month away. And what's so frustrating is at this point, Hitler knew that the war was over and yet still wanted to get revenge on the guys that had conspired against him. So he had all of that group put to death, and Bonhoeffer, he knew it, and so as he was walking away, the last time anyone would see or hear from him, he grabbed one of his buddies who was also, this is what he said to him. He said, this is the end, for me, the beginning of life. Would you join me in prayer, and then we'll close with worship. Father, so challenged by it. The example that Bonhoeffer sets, and just acknowledge that I'm a lot more like the other leaders who just went with the flow, put their head down, did what was comfortable. And so it takes courage. It takes courage to be willing to stand up when no one else is. And it takes courage to follow Jesus, and for Bonhoeffer, he got it right. That starts by understanding the gospel, that you gave us everything, that the cost of grace is not cheap, And so how can we not do the same for those in our life, for the people around us? And so I pray this morning that we would be encouraged and that we would be challenged to take our faith and to put it into action in whatever way that looks like in our own situation, in our own context. And it's in Jesus' name I pray. Amen.
Please stand.